Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We are now in the third week of the U.S.-Iran conflict, and investors remain focused on how long it could last and the potential economic consequences. Now, there are other developments relevant for the investment outlook, including economic data and how the Fed incorporates the oil price shock into its decision-making at the FOMC meeting this week. So, joining us here on this Monday morning to discuss this all for the CIO Strategy Snapshot, glad to welcome back Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Jason Dreho. Jason, a lot has, of course, taken place since you and I last spoke, so it's great to have you back on the podcast today. Thank you for joining our listeners and our clients on this Monday morning.
Good morning, John. Happy Monday. Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks since we talked, and obviously a lot has happened during that time period.
So with that, Jason, perhaps geopolitics a good place to start. Can you bring our listeners up to speed as far as CIO's latest thinking on the U.S.-Iran conflict, when it might be resolved, and the outlook for oil?
Well, we can do a lot of speculation in terms of how this could be resolved, when it could be resolved. I think from the market's perspective, really what matters more is, you know, in terms of the duration of the conflict, and how this will impact, you know, oil prices, and, you know, the passage of oil and other, you know, goods through the Strait of Hormuz, and how long that could be disrupted in one way or another. You know, our base case remains that the hostilities between the U.S. and Iran will not lead to a sustained rise in energy prices, even if, you know, the events remain uncertain, you know, at least for the next couple of weeks, if not a little bit longer. If you look at what happened just over the past, you know, few days of the weekend, on Friday, the U.S. bombed military targets on Iran's main oil export hub on Karg Island. And President Trump threatened additional strikes, can you target energy facilities if, you know, Tehran doesn't or continues to block the Strait of Hormuz, and warned Iran that there could be more consequences of attacks on its energy infrastructure. Trump has also said in statements that the U.S. has achieved its military objectives and now seeking to international support to reopen the strait, you know, and we kind of interpret that as an indication that the U.S. is ultimately looking for an off-ramp. And according to an article in the Wall Street Journal, the Trump administration does plan to announce this week that it has formed a coalition with a number of companies to help escort ships through the strait. So, you know, while obviously the uncertainty remains high, there's clearly, you know, the administration looks like they want to, you know, still have this resolved within 4 to 6 weeks, which was the initial sort of time frame laid out by the president, you know, 2 weeks ago. And just as a positive note to kind of reinforce this view, you know, two tankers carrying liquefied petroleum gas to India did go through the strait over the weekend. So there is some signs of, at least, you know, it's not complete shutdown. But ultimately, though, in terms of going back to the price of oil, you know, the situation is very much in flux, and, you know, the combination of, you know, these supply disruptions, and sort of limited offset from increasing the, you know, releases from the strategic reserves means that oil prices are likely to stay higher for longer, even if the flows through the Strait of Hormuz resume, you know, and within a few weeks. As a result, our commodities team has upgraded their price targets for Brent crude, and now expecting it to be $90 a barrel at the end of June. This is up from 65, and then it falls to 85 by end of September, 85 in December, then down to 80 by next March. So it will take a while for this to normalize. These are the prices for Brent at WTI in the U.S. You know, it always tends to be a little bit lower, but like, let's assume about $4 or $5 lower per barrel. So a level shift higher of almost, you know, $15 to $20 kind of across, you know, the time horizon that we're talking about. So even if this disruption gets resolved, relatively soon, meaning within the next month, just the fact that your strategic reserves will be drained, and, you know, last week, OECD countries agreed to release 400 million barrels from their strategic reserves. As they release those, it takes not only them to then sort of rebuild it, but that also kind of augments the, you know, demand overall for oil. And all that leads to higher oil prices going forward. Now, these forecasts assume that the strait will resume by end of March, early in May, or early in April. If the disruptions last longer, then, you know, ultimately you can see, you know, Brent going all the way to $150 a barrel, to ultimately you would need some demand destruction to curtail demand to bring kind of prices lower. So there are certainly risks of going higher in near term. The idea that we get back to price levels that existed, you know, just a month ago, that's unlikely to happen anytime soon. So the situation may resolve, you know, in terms of at least oil impact and oil disruptions to the supply, you know, relatively soon, but the impact for high oil prices are likely to linger through much of this year into early next year as well.
Now, one of the key questions, Jason, is how the surge in oil prices could impact the economy. What is the risk and what does the current data say about the state of the economy?
Well, if we think about just the potential risk to the economy from high oil prices, there's a general sort of rule of thumb that a sustained increase in the price of oil by $10 per barrel, well, you know, would drag down GDP growth by about, 10 basis points, all else equal. And so if you think of, oil staying at, roughly the 85 and 90 range versus 65, prior to that, let's say that's, $20 a barrel higher and it's sustained throughout the rest of this year, that could drag down growth ultimately, 10 to 20 basis points. Like that's historical relationships. Over time, the U.S. has become, more energy independent. It's the largest, oil producer in the world. And so sometimes high oil prices, also its consumers, can benefit producers. It's unlikely if prices do start to moderate that you're going to see much of a ramp up in production. But the U.S. versus some other economies, certainly in Asia, to Europe to some extent, because of this sort of relative energy independence, is a little bit more immune to higher oil prices overall. But it's still a negative. It's still inflationary. It's still sort of a stagflationary shock, which kind of reflects the market performance of late. If we hold constant, the oil dynamics and what's happening there and the potential impact going forward, if we actually look at the recent data, it is still consistent with the base case that we had that growth would be around 2.5% this year, give or take, a tenth or two, measured by kind of a fourth quarter this year versus fourth quarter last year. Last week, there was GDP data for the fourth quarter, a revision to it, and it was revised lower by 70 basis points, down to 0.7 from 1.4%. And this was revised lower due to kind of exports being revised lower, consumer spending also following. But just to put in context, consumer spending, if you look at the consumer overall, it went from 2.4 to 2%. And real domestic final sales growth, which kind of strips out the noise from exports, from inventories, was still 1.9%. So still relatively solid private sector demand, although that is a step down from where growth was in the second and third quarter of last year. Then we look at more real-time data. The jobs report that we got for February, was weak. It came in at minus 92,000 in terms of job growth, when the consensus is about expecting plus 55,000. But if we take a step back and look at the labor market picture overall, some of the weakness in February could reflect sort of a payback from January being so overstated. There's a lot of seasonal issues with the January jobs data. And if we look at sort of a 3 and 4 month kind of moving average, it looks like not necessarily a trend shift lower, but just to continue with sort of soft labor market. And other indicators such as, jobless claims or announced job openings, you don't show uptick in job losses, which suggests that the unemployment rate is likely to have, kind of still stabilize around the current level, like say 4.3 to 4.5, percent. One of the reasons why we're optimistic on growth this year instead of acceleration is that the benefits of the stimulus package from last year, the One Big Beautiful Bill, should be kicking in. Something that we're tracking closely is the tax refunds. They're expected to be larger this year, given that the tax cuts were retroactive. As of about a week ago, they were up about $13 billion year over year, and average refunds look to be about up 11%. The data, though, is tracking the lower end of the estimates of between $50 to $100 billion in terms of sort of tax refunds, incremental to above and beyond what is normally done. So what it looks like, though, is it's likely to be maybe later in the season, so more of a 2Q story in terms of growth impact rather than the first quarter story, as opposed to the overall sort of stimulus benefit being kind of lower than initially anticipated. When we get that sort of benefit of the tax cuts, but also lower tax payments kind of going forward, we expect that job growth will rebound to some extent and supported by a firmer kind of growth outlook. So put in the big picture, if we abstract what's going on from the high oil prices due to the conflict in the Middle East, the macro story is playing out largely as kind of we expected. Labor market is yet to kind of improve, but it's not necessarily getting any worse despite the February data. And the stimulus benefits, including accelerated investment, should lead to pickup in growth in the second quarter. That should support job growth going forward.
Now, as far as how the Fed may be assessing this all, the Fed, of course, does meet this week to decide on changes to interest rates, this in light of the higher oil prices. Jason, what are you expecting from the meeting this week, and how could oil impact the Fed's rate-cutting decisions?
Well, high oil prices certainly doesn't make the Fed's life any easier because it is going to be an inflationary shock. It's one of the reasons why, if you look at market pricing, it's now down to only one cut this year, and that doesn't occur until December. If you think about where we were in early January, it was close to 2.5 to 3 cuts in a first full cut, by June. And now that's definitely been pushed out. Ultimately, we still expect the Fed's going to cut twice this year in June and September. The risk is that this could be delayed a little bit. But the rationale for this ultimately is the inflation impact, especially to core inflation from higher oil prices, is relatively modest. And using that sort of same kind of rule of thumb for growth, a $10 increase in the barrel of oil for a sustained period of time should translate into about 4 basis points higher of core inflation. And for headline, it would be higher, it could be closer to 20 basis points, but the Fed is going to kind of look through that and focus on core inflation. The underlying trends for inflation, by and large, still seem to be moving in the right direction. Shelter inflation is going lower. Some of the goods inflation, showed, an uptick in February. That is kind of consistent with the tariff story still having an impact, and we think that's going to still to play out and work its way through the system, by the end of the second quarter. But nonetheless, higher inflation doesn't make it easier for the Fed to cut. But the market pricing seems to be a little bit overreacting. Ultimately, the Fed has a dual mandate, both higher inflation and job growth. And so while there's a risk of higher inflation, at least the headline numbers for an extended period of time because of oil prices, the February jobs data, as much as we can try to suggest it's implying a stabilizing labor market, does highlight the fact that there is significant downside risk to the labor market. And so from the Fed's perspective, and something that Jay Powell might say during his press conference at the end of the FOMC meeting, is that the risks were imbalanced. Inflation risks have increased, but also labor market risks have also increased to the downside. And so you net it all out, the Fed's outlook remains kind of relatively balanced. So as a result, in terms of what to expect for the Fed this meeting, no rate cut. They may, they'll likely can update their economic projections to show slightly higher inflation, slightly lower growth for 2026, slightly higher unemployment rate, what you would get from a sort of a negative supply side shock. The median dot at the December meeting implied one cut this year. We expect that to be the same, this time as well. It will require pretty big change among different committee members to shift that median from one cut to either no cuts or very likely goes to two cuts at this point in time. So largely kind of status quo meeting, and the Fed is kind of operating in a bit of a fog. Powell will probably reiterate at that point. And just regarding some of the market pricing, it's priced out a lot of cuts this year, or at least pushed things further back. This has also occurred last week, largely the week in which it's part of the Fed blackout period going into the FOMC. So there was no Fed official was able to kind of talk back and push back against the market pricing. And so Powell's comments could sort of challenge some of that view, and you could see the market then sort of reprice back some of these cuts to sort of pull them forward after the FOMC and after the Fed had indicated its willingness to perhaps look through the Fed meetings. In terms of the cuts, we're maintaining our view of June and September. And there's basically two paths for the Fed to get there. One ultimately is that it's an inflation story, and inflation, trends look like they're moving in the right direction. So that core goods inflation over the next 3 to 6 months, look like they have peaked. And by the time they get to the June meeting, they'll have May data. And from March to May, that could look a lot better. So if they don't, put too much emphasis on oil, then core inflation could fall enough for them to justify cutting in June. Another factor for them to be able to cut in June is if we get another 1 or 2 months of weak jobs numbers, higher unemployment rate, that could override the inflation data. So there's different paths for the Fed to be still cutting in June. And I think the market has become a little bit perhaps too pessimistic on that prospect.
So let's end, Jason, on investment recommendations. What are the key messages at this time from the UBS Chief Investment Office, and how should investors navigate market turbulence?
Well, let me start with just reiterating the macro view that we had for this year of, solid growth, kind of with growth accelerating in the first half, a Fed that is still biased towards cutting, twice this year. So far, we don't think that view has materially changed, or the developments for the past 2 weeks haven't materially changed that outlook. And those are supportive conditions for risk assets and equities in particular to do well. So I think for that reason, you know, if we take a medium-term view, like a full-year view, we still remain kind of optimistic on that. But we have to acknowledge that in the near term, uncertainty remains high. The markets could react to any sort of news flow and will react to any news flow regarding potential either opening of the Strait of Hormuz or further disruptions that could take kind of longer. And there's certainly a downside risk if the perceptions are this will not reopen within the next month. It does look like investor sentiment and positioning has gotten kind of closer to neutral. And by and large, I think there's a lot of investors who, during the first week of this conflict, were sort of relatively sanguine, thought that there would be, the president would ultimately kind of, step back on terms of his the actions, if the market and the economic implications became too negative. After the second week, I think the sentiment on that got a little more pessimistic. Not that, the Trump administration is not aware of the economic considerations, but unlike, say, with tariffs where they can unilaterally take action, this situation with Iran is not unilateral. They have to kind of also respond to what Iran does. And so I think there's a little bit more pessimism that has creeped into the markets as a result. I think you're seeing something on the market performance reflect that. And that could be, investors in the markets overall can be very sensitive to any news flow over the next few weeks on this regard. As a result, we continue to sort of believe that the best way to sort of navigate this environment is to make sure that you're sort of diversified across different asset classes, sectors, and regions, something that we've been sort of advocating way back, prior to these developments. Looking at other sort of, hedges, such as capital preservation strategies, we continue to like gold and commodities as sort of, diversifiers as a way to sort of, kind of navigate through this environment. I think the key thing is the overall medium-term message, remains kind of constructive, and investors shouldn't be looking to, to kind of panic and fearful that, there's a lot more downside that it's really is a risk, but, a mild growth scare would suggest the markets would have maybe a little more to fall from here, but ultimately we think the fundamentals still suggest better growth ahead, and that's a better environment for equities. And the last point I'd make on equities is that a key driver for U.S. equities in particular is the AI capex investment that could drive a big part of the S&P earnings. That's going to be less sensitive to what's happening in the Middle East. So the upside there for earnings still looks attractive, and based off the completion of the Q1 earnings season, we still feel quite confident that earnings outlook this year will sort of materialize, barring a much more tail risk scenario with oil prices spiking all the way to $150 a barrel.
Well, Jason, a very helpful conversation as we begin another trading week. Thank you for dropping by to share with our listeners, our clients, your assessment of the current geopolitical environment, the economic environment, how it's all translating to the markets, perhaps influencing monetary policy, and how to position portfolios accordingly. So thanks again for dropping by, Jason. And have a great week ahead.
You too.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.